The test is in four part, part one, part two, part three, and part four. Now look at part one.
Part one.
You'll hear two university students planning a computer programming lesson. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 4. Now listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 4.
Hi, Hardeep. Is now a good time for us to plan that computer programming lesson we've been assigned?
Hey, Dawn. I was just thinking about that, actually. Yes, let's get it out of the way now, shall we? I've got the instructions here. So, it says, design a 45-minute lesson for a class of 16 teenagers where they learn how to write a simple computer program in BASIC.
Now, I know, of course, that BASIC is the computer language people used to use back in the 1980s when they wrote programs on microcomputers, but I'm not sure I feel very comfortable teaching anyone about it.
Well, I did a bit of research yesterday and found out quite a few things, so I think we'll be okay.
Great. So, what do you have in mind?
Well, I think we should presume that none of the kids will know anything about BASIC. So, why don't we start with a short multiple-choice quiz? It could focus on things like what BASIC is, what the letters stand for, when people used it, things like that.
That sounds good. I guess it shouldn't take long. Just the first 5 minutes of the lesson, something like that. I don't think we should make the students do it on their own, though. That'd make it too much like a test. Shall we let them do it in twos so they can discuss their choices?
Yes, good idea. Then we'll go through the answers with them as a whole group.
Good. What next?
Well, I've had an idea for the program they could write. I'll tell you about that in a minute. I think the key thing is, though, that before they actually sit at their computers, and I think we should presume that they're doing this lesson in a computer room, they make a flow chart of what they want the program to do. That's usually the best way to start writing a program.
This flow chart will show all the different stages of the computer program, right?
Exactly. It's probably best if the teacher stands at the board and everyone works on that together.
Yes, otherwise they'll all come up with different flow charts and it'll get confusing.
Precisely. I imagine making the flowchart will take about 15 to 20 minutes.
Then they use that to write their computer program.
Well, actually, I think there's a stage before that. You see, the flowchart will be in English. They're going to need to be taught a few basic commands so they can write their computer program.
Now I'm getting out of my depth. What kind of thing would that be?
Well, for example, when you want text to appear on the screen, the command is print in capital letters, followed by the text you want to appear in double inverted commas.
Oh, yes. I think I've seen that before.
Right. So they'll need to be taught 5 or 6 commands before they use them to write their program.
Okay. So how shall we do that? With the teacher talking to the whole class again?
Well, we could, but it might be more fun to make it more like a competition, where there are a few teams competing against each other. Each team has maybe 4 or 5 people in it, and they have to do some kind of matching task. You know, they match the command print with to make text appear on the screen, something like that.
That sounds good. Teenagers love competing with each other.
Exactly. And then, for the final part of the lesson, they use their flowchart and the commands they've learned to produce the program. Let's presume, shall we, that there are 8 computers in the room, so that's 2 students for each computer.
That sounds reasonable. So, tell me more about your idea for the computer program they're going to write.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 5 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 5 to 10.
Okay, so it's a very simple program. I've actually written it down here so we can go through it together.
Okay, so the first line says 10 CLS. What on earth does that mean?
Well, every line of a basic computer program starts with a number. They usually go up in tens. So the first line is 10, the second 20, and so on. And CLS is the command we use in BASIC to clear the screen.
Oh, I see. So that's just telling the computer to start with a blank screen.
Exactly. Then we move on to the next line. So this one says 20, print, guess a number between 1 and 10.
Right, I see. That appears on the screen. It's not that difficult, is it, when you get the hang of it? Let's see if I can work out the next one. 30, input I. Oh, not sure about that.
Well, all that's saying is that the person playing types in a number. Input is the basic command for type in, and I just means any number you like.
Oh, okay.
Then what happens next depends on what the number is. So we've got 40 if I is less than 1, or if I is greater than 10. Then print, bad choice.
Right. So if they type, say, 0 or 11, that appears on the screen.
Exactly. And then this next line takes them back to where it asks them to type in a number between 1 and 10.
That's line 50. I see. And line 60 says, if I equals 6, then print. Correct. Ah, okay. So if they've typed 6, they've got it right.
And if they haven't typed 6, which is the next line, then try again comes up on the screen, and that takes them back to where they choose another number.
It's clever. Well done.
That is the end of part 1.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part 2.
Part 2.
You will hear some students talking about an assignment. Listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 15.
Hello, Tom.
Hello, Anne.
What have you been doing?
Oh, just sitting around, catching up with some reading.
I've had a great time. You know we're doing this assignment on... what is it?
Museums, their costs and benefits.
That's right. Well, I've been to the Sandgate Museum. It was really good. These local museums are really interesting because they connect people with the history of one special place. We all know about kings and emperors and battles and wars, but local museums tell us about the everyday lives of ordinary people, and that's why they are so important.
I'm not so sure about that. I think they are of interest, but they're so small that they can't give a true picture. They do their best.
I don't really agree. They do give a true picture, but perhaps not a full picture. It's the truth, but not the whole truth.
I think the smallness is the number one problem. Because they're small and local, they attract few visitors. That's why they have so little money. And because they have little money, they can't buy or maintain many really interesting exhibits. As a result, the shop is almost as big as the museum to try to raise money by selling souvenirs, postcards, sweets and so on.
I think they find it difficult, but not impossible. And don't forget, they get a lot of their exhibits free from local people. There was this boat, for example, that was fantastic.
Really? What was that?
There was a massive fishing boat, a real one, about 100 years old, and you could walk on it and get the feeling of what fishing in those days was really like.
Sounds quite good. But I've always found that these kinds of museums are a bit dingy. For example, the display cabinets are so dark that you can hardly see the exhibits, and the labels are sometimes difficult to read.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20.
So coming back to our assignment, what we've got to decide is whether these museums should be funded by the government or just by local people.
I think it depends entirely on what kind of museum it is.
How do you mean?
Well, take local history museums. They are small, so they won't survive without financial support. But that should come from the local authority, since only people in that area, or tourists, will visit it.
I agree. But what about big natural history museums? Surely they should get money from the central government.
Why? Children who want to learn about nature can go out into the countryside with their school teachers. They could survive from donations, and they get loads of visitors anyway. The state should spend more on science museums, since not enough people are studying science these days.
I'm not so sure. But I do think a sort of museum which should not get public funds is the craft museum.
Yes, like museums of cotton weaving.
Yeah, which are of interest to only a very small number of people, and they should pay for it.
I agree. But a working farm is a different thing again. That's something from the past of all of us, and so it's important to the local community. Kids can learn a lot too. That's the sort of thing that the local government should be spending its money on.
Yes, I agree. Well, I think we've got plenty of ideas for our assignment.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You'll hear an interview with a wildlife specialist called Alison Sharp talking about bears. In the first part of the discussion, they are talking about the history of the bear. First, look at questions 21 to 23. Now listen to the first part of the interview and answer questions 21 to 23.
Alison Sharp has spent much of her life researching bears, and in particular, bears in danger of extinction. She is the author of a recent book on bears, and we welcome her to the studio today.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
First of all, can you give us a quick overview of the history of the bear family?
Well, the bears we know today actually have as their ancestors bears which have been evolving for some 40 million years. We have fossils of the earliest true bear, and it's important to emphasize this because some creatures are called bears but are not.
Such as koalas, for instance.
Yes, exactly. Fossils of the true bear show a small dog-sized animal with characteristics that show a blending of dog and bear traits.
So the general belief is that dogs and bears were of the same family?
Yes, that's the theory. And then we see the arrival of the early cave bear. We know from cave drawings that Neanderthal man used to worship this bear and at the same time fear it.
Understandable, perhaps.
Yes, but they need not have worried because the cave bear only ate plants. In fact, the cave bear survived two ice ages, but then became extinct.
In the second part of the interview, Alison talks more about the situation of bears today. Look at questions 24 to 30 first. Listen carefully and answer questions 24 to 30.
So, how many bears can we find today? And are any of them in danger of extinction?
Well, I'll answer your first question first. There are 8 species of bear in all, among them the American black bear and the brown bear, from which evolved the newest species of bear, the polar bear.
So, how old is the polar bear?
Oh, he's a relative newcomer, just 20,000 years old.
And could you tell us a little about them? Which is the largest bear, for instance?
Well, the largest bear existing today is either the polar bear or the brown bear.
Right. Don't we know?
Well, it depends which criteria you use. The polar bear is the heaviest. The male weighs up to 1,500 pounds, but his narrow body actually makes him look smaller than the much more robust brown bear.
So the brown bear appears the biggest?
Yes.
And the smallest?
Well, the sun bear is the smallest of the 8 species. They only weigh between 60 and 145 pounds.
That makes him a comparative junior.
Yes. And then next we have the so-called giant panda. But that's a small bear too, comparatively speaking.
And are all bears meat eaters?
No, not at all. In fact, the giant panda is almost entirely herbivorous, living on a diet of 30 types of bamboo.
Yes, of course. Pandas are famous for that.
And another interesting bear is the sloth bear, which eats insects, particularly termites. Mm. He can turn his mouth into a tube and suck the insects out of their nests.
So, going back to my second question, mm-hmm. Are bears really in danger of extinction?
Yes, indeed, they are. The sun bear in particular, as they've been hunted almost out of existence. And the habitat of the panda is also being reduced on a daily basis.
Can anything be done to reduce the threat to these endangered species? I know, for instance, that it's very hard to breed bears in captivity.
Yes, well, I think that by raising people's awareness generally, we can reduce conflict between humans and animals to stop the slaughter in parts of the world where bears are still hunted, supposedly in self-defense or to protect livestock, but often quite unnecessarily. And we can also encourage governments to preserve the natural environment of the bear, rather than allow the areas where they live to be systematically destroyed in the name of progress.
Yes, of course.
And in addition to these global efforts, All profits from the sale of my book will go toward the United Nations Bear Protection Program.
That's wonderful. And with the news coming up, thank you for your time, Alison, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part four.
Part four.
You'll hear an introduction about the tutorial courses of the physics school.
First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Welcome to Orientation Week. This is the Physics School session, and we'll welcome Professor Smith, the head of the school, to introduce you to the tutorial system. Welcome, Professor Smith.
Thank you. You may have noticed life at university is totally different from that of school. For you, tutorials are an important part of the teaching program. Tutors are the primary contact between undergraduate students and the school. A tutor is the student's personal tutor as well as their academic tutor. Tutorials for physics undergraduates consist of 6 students who meet each week with their tutor for at least 50 minutes. For radiographer students, tutorials will normally consist of a group of about 10 students who will meet fortnightly with their tutor for a period of at least 50 minutes. In the first semester, the tutorials are during weeks 1 to 11. For semester 2, they are during weeks 14 to 24. Everybody involved is expected to be present and on time, and the tutor will also be available in week 12 and 25 to discuss problems that arise during revision. But attendance by students is optional. Now I'm going to introduce to you the stages and activities of the tutorials. The induction period is from week 1 to 3. I know that a significant minority of you experience culture shock during your first few months at university, and the important function of this stage is to identify students who are having difficulty integrating into the academic program. In particular, tutors should check your attendance of lectures, tutorials, laboratory sessions, and this sort of things. Tutors also help you tackle work in a systematic and effective manner. Stage 2 begins from the 4th week. Some tutorials of this period are to be devoted to discussion or going over the students' lecture notes, but approximately 50% of tutorial time is to be devoted to coursework. You should finish the weekly homework assignments of 2 hours duration with at least 50% involving written work. At least 8 homework assignments during the year should involve answering problems set on coursework. The written work collected by the tutor should be marked within a week of handing in, and generally the assignments should be graded. The third stage starts from week 8 till the 10th. During this period, math and 4 core physics programs are included. The majority of tutorial time should be devoted to work which supports the lecture programs and laboratory work. At least 60% of homework assignments should involve written work. The assignment may involve writing an account of, or notes on, a specified range of topics. The written work should also be marked and graded. Short oral presentations by students should be included. They are possibly on general physics topics or essays. The last week's personal development planning is a structured and supported process. The primary objective for PDP is to help you to become more independent and confident, self-directed learners and encourage a positive attitude to learning throughout life. It is undertaken by yourselves to reflect upon their own learning, performance and achievement, and to plan for their personal, educational and career development. Finally, if without evidence of good reason you miss more than 2 sessions during a semester, or if the tutor is not satisfied with your progress, the matter must be immediately referred to the program director, who will normally issue formal warning, verbal and written. This will inform you that your place at university is under threat of withdrawal if no improvement is made.
That is the end of part 4.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.